This evening, our scripture reading is Daniel chapter 6. Daniel chapter 6. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at the story of Daniel's three friends in the furnace of fire. And of course, there are some obvious similarities between the two, and there are some similar points. But whereas in that chapter, we looked a little more at the standing for God on the part of the three friends, this evening our emphasis is going to be a little more on the protection granted by God to the righteous. So some different points and a little bit of a different emphasis. But obviously, of course, very similar truths in both chapters. Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first. Then the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault. For as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, "We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king, and thus said unto him, "King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not." Wherefore the king Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house. And his windows being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed, and gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. "Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not." Then answered they and said before the king, "That Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition three times a day." Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, "Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed." Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said unto Daniel, "Thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee." And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God hath sent his angel, and hath shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceeding glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. And the lions had the mastery of them, and brake all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den. And King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwelt in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Daniel was a young man, as were his three friends, in the very difficult situation of being surrounded by pagans, of being surrounded by people who denied the deepest and most important truths of Daniel's tradition and of his experience. He was also surrounded by people who very much disliked him. And his life, I think we are fairly safe in assuming, had many difficulties and many unpleasant moments. But yet the Lord delivered him. And the Lord delivered him because of righteousness. Daniel's righteousness, but also ultimately, as we're going to see, because of God's righteousness. Daniel was a young man highly thought of by the pagans. And here already we begin to see some of that tension that we also find in the Christian life. The New Testament tells us that we should do all things well, that we should obey the laws, that we should be free from vice, free from dishonesty. We should serve our employers well, so that even those who hate the gospel may have nothing evil to say of us. Always behave in the way that is right, says the New Testament, so that those who are out to get you can bring no charge against you. Daniel had obviously done that very well. He had risen to a high position, both under King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonians and under King Darius, or Darius, both ways, of the Persians. That must have been a constant effort. He was greatly in favor with the king of the Persians, as we see here. Even when Daniel broke the king's decree, the king was not angry at Daniel. He was angry at himself. And he sought ways to save Daniel. Daniel must have been very highly thought of by the king. And I think we can safely guess that that did not come easily. That represents a great effort and determination on Daniel's part to work in the power of the Lord and to be righteous. Daniel, of course, is not the only one we see in the Bible who did such things, who became highly admired by the pagans. Abraham earned a great deal of respect. Joseph, Solomon, Naaman's slave girl, I suspect, was very beloved by her master and her mistress, especially after she gave Naaman a name by which he might be cured. Of course, we have Daniel's three friends. In the New Testament, we have the Apostle Paul, so hated in some ways, but yet obviously admired by many around him, including the unbelievers, those in the Roman government. It's a difficult thing, but yet that's what we're called on to do. And note how Daniel's righteousness and the righteousness of his friends in that difficult situation protected them from so much. The world hates Daniel, but his righteousness protects him. But note an irony as well. It is his very righteousness which will, in a sense, get him in trouble. Daniel is admired by the king. And those who are envious of him, those who are jealous of him, are, in a sense, envious of him because of his righteousness, because of his efficiency, because of his goodness in doing his job. But perhaps even more ironic, or from a human point of view, harder to take, is the fact that the reason for Daniel's righteousness, his loyalty to the Lord, is what ultimately gives them a way to get him. They recognize that, these men who hated Daniel and were envious of him. Look at verse 5. Then said these men, "We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Why did Daniel maintain his righteousness right from the beginning? It was because of the law of his God, and that protected him. But now for a time, it seems as if that's the very thing that's going to get him in trouble. These evil men realize that. The only way they will get him is through his faithfulness to the law of his God. In passing, how many of us can say that about ourselves, or how many people could say that about us? Boy, the only way we're going to find something against him is as it involves his unwavering faithfulness to his God. Did the world say that about many of us? In a sense, that's a wonderful position to be in for Daniel, isn't it? Nothing against him, but his faithfulness to his God. And in a sense, I do think we face the same challenge today. In many ways, Christians outshine the world. Now, that's certainly not without exception. I don't mean in every way. I don't mean Christians are better looking, better athletes, richer, more successful. I don't mean that. But in many ways, those who do follow the Bible do stand out. I have seen that more and more as I experience Christian families who live out in the world. Even those families who mock them and ridicule them inwardly admire them. And it shows at times. They come to them. They respect them. One of the things I think the world hates in Christians is when Christians don't go along with worldly thought. I think that's a big part of the reason for much of the hostility on the part of some toward Christian schools or to homeschooling. They don't like those Christians turning out their children even better than the world's children. I don't mean to suggest that children from Christian homes always do turn out better than everybody in the world. I don't mean that at all. But the point is, the world resents it when those they hate do a good job. And I suspect we will see more and more in the years ahead that the world is going to attack Christians not because they don't do as well at worldly things, but because they are Christians. Again, just thinking of education, I think they're giving up pretty much on the idea that Christian schools or homeschooling doesn't do as well academically. And now they've got to go after the very fact that they're teaching them about God, or as the world puts it, teaching them to be intolerant. See, it's the very Christianity itself that they're going to have to attack. It was certainly that way for Daniel. They couldn't get him on anything else. So they eventually had to go at the heart of it, his faithfulness to his God. They are envious of Daniel, and they find a way to turn Daniel's loyalness to the God of Israel against him. They get the king, perhaps appealing to the king's vanity, to pass a decree that says that for a time, no one shall ask anything of any other god or power save of the king himself. Now, the king, who obviously had some knowledge of the God of Israel, he certainly had admiration for Daniel, is still a man. And perhaps it was his weakness, his pride, that leads him to do such a foolish thing. But he agrees to the decree. No one may make any petition of any god, but only of the king. If the king was distraught about what was done to Daniel, in a sense, he earned it, didn't he? Once again, it was his own foolishness, his own pride, that put him in such a situation. What does Daniel do when he hears the decree, verses 10 and 11? He doesn't even hesitate, does he? Just like his three friends, he goes and worships his God and prays to his God. Look at verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. He did not change. We have no indication that he even hesitated for a moment. Just as he had done before, he continued to pray to his God. And now note, there are limits to the worldly protection afforded by Daniel's worldly righteousness. In that pagan land, Daniel received a great deal of protection from the king, obviously, and more, protection and power. But now Daniel's righteousness, in a sense, his favor with the world, with the king, is going to show its limits. Not even the king, having foolishly signed the decree, can ignore the law of the Medes and the Persians. And now not even the king can protect Daniel. Young people, you're going to find, as you get older, that even in a very practical way, keeping God's law protects you from all kinds of trouble. When you look at what the world worries about, the diseases, the addictions, the marital, psychological, and social unhappiness, the neuroses, the psychoses, the fears, the tensions, all of the grief around you. You will be amazed as you grow older at how much of that is self-caused, at how much of that, even humanly speaking, could have been avoided if people just did what was right. I remember, as I think I've said many, many times, growing up in the late 60s, and so many of the young people of my generation were going along with the conventional wisdom, with the drugs, the immorality, the drinking, the liberation that the 60s promised, and how out of place, how simple, how much like hits all those young people seemed who just would not go along with it at all. And yet, how many troubles were they not spared because they refused to abandon God's law? How much grief wouldn't we have avoided in our own lives if we had kept the law? So you see, even at a very practical level, this is true that God protects the righteous. Even at that day-to-day level, there is great truth here. God protects those who keep his ways. And you will come to so much less grief if you keep his ways. But you will have trials, and Daniel is going to have a trial. Verse 16, the king says to Daniel, "May the God whom you serve protect you." Daniel is out of human protection here. But now this king, who must know a good deal about the law, about the God of Israel, says, "The God whom you serve, may he protect you." Look at verse 19. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee? The king has a good idea of Daniel's God, but he doesn't know him as well as he should he? Of course, the God of Daniel, who is the God of heaven and earth, can deliver Daniel from the lions. If our translation is correct, the king doesn't say, did he only, but there seems to be some question about, could he? Is thy God whom thou servest able to deliver thee from the lions? And of course, the answer is yes. And Daniel answers that God has shut the lions' mouths. Verse 22, my God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths. Now, why did God shut the lions' mouths? These lions here, so representative of evil, of the powers of evil, of the desire of the world to consume the righteous. Why did God defang those lions? Look at Daniel's answer. My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lions' mouths that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him, innocency was found in me. Or in some other translations, a little more modern, because no guilt was found in me. No wrongdoing was found in me. Once again, Daniel's righteousness by the power of God has protected him. In many cultures throughout the world, including in our own Western culture, for many hundreds of years, there was a way of judging guilt or innocence in society when there was no good technological evidence, when there was no good technology, or even if there weren't enough witnesses around. There was a legal process called the ordeal. Many of you may be familiar with it in some form. What would happen is that the accuser would bring an accusation against the accused, and then the accused would have to go some severe physical trial. For example, to use just one example, to use just one type, the accused might have to swear that they were innocent, then reach into a cauldron of boiling water and pick up a rock or a piece of iron and take it out of that boiling water. Then their hand would be bandaged, and in 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, they would come back to court, the hand would be unwrapped. If the hand was healing normally, they were innocent. If the hand was festering and infected, they were considered guilty. Now, that was just one among many variants. There were things about walking over hot coals. There were things about being thrown into water. That's one that survived even into American colonial times, a test for witches. Bound up, thrown into the water, see if the water received them or not. But the point behind all of that was, God protects the righteous. Now, I wouldn't advocate a return to those legal practices. And in fact, by 1100 or 1200 AD, the church and the governments in Europe were outlawing them. The church called them an improper testing of God, and perhaps that's true. But I think those processes did reveal a great truth. The maker of heaven and earth controls the elements, fire and water and the human body and wild animals. And the Lord protects the righteous. What's interesting is in some of these cases, a result would be given which many of the people knew was incorrect. For example, someone they knew had done it would come back with a hand that was healing. But even in those cases, they would say, ah, there is more here than we know about. For some reason, even though this person did the deed, they are still innocent in God's eyes, perhaps because of things we don't know about. In other words, rightly or wrongly, they were willing to accept these strange verdicts because they trusted that ultimately God protected the righteous. It's similar to what we see here in Daniel. I think it's similar to what we see in the story of David. Why could David face Goliath? Because he was right before the Lord. In the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 5, there is a test to see if women have been unfaithful, the test of bitter waters. It involves women taking in water, and then certain processes are done. You can read about it in Numbers 5. And then they check to see if the woman experiences discomfort or if the stomach swells. And then it was known whether the woman had remained pure or not. Now, again, I'm not recommending we go back to that. But have we lost sight of the fact that the Lord protects the righteous? The world is ultimately His, and those who are right before Him will not suffer ultimate harm. Look at verse 23. Then was the king exceeding glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him because he believed in his God. Now you might say with a great deal of truth, but that doesn't happen today. Christians aren't protected from getting physically hurt. It doesn't always work out right. No, it doesn't. Not in the short run. But you see, for the Christian, what counts is eternity. What counts is not is the body protected from all harm, but is the soul protected from all harm? And when that day comes, will I stand before the Lord? Before we move on to that point, just one other thing to note. Verse 24. Daniel's accusers are then thrown to the lions. Now, you may have wondered while we were talking about these other medieval legal practices, well, couldn't you just then accuse somebody you didn't like to make them go through this painful thing? Let's say you know they didn't do it, but you accuse them of it, so they have to go through this horrible, painful ordeal. Well, you could do that. The problem was that in many cases, in most countries, in most areas, if you accuse someone and they pass the ordeal, then you underwent it. So, no, you didn't just accuse anybody you wanted to. But again, I think there's a deeper truth there. Those who falsely accuse the Christian, those who accuse the Christian, who accuse God's people out of hatred and envy, their accusations will come back on their own head. And someday it will be the saints who rule. And they will be justified before the world. And the world will have to acknowledge that they were God's people. But now what about that idea? God protecting His people. Well, here, today, on earth, God does protect the righteous. We've already mentioned to what a great extent it is true that keeping God's law keeps you from trouble. Think of just some typical examples, particular communicable diseases that the world is in so much fear of because of the way they live. Think of the sadness in marriage. Think of the violence in families because of those who did not live the way they are called upon to live. So much of that the Christian is free from if they keep God's law. Psalm 34, verses 19 and 20. We're going to look at just very briefly at three verses here. You might want to turn to Psalm 34, verses 19 and 20. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all. He keepeth all his bones, not one of them is broken. Now again, in a sense, that's not literally true. Christians get broken bones, including when they're being persecuted. But you see, the Christian is not lost. Let's look at another one, Psalm 91. Psalm 91, look at verses 5 through 8. All of these things that happen to people around you, thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day. Look at verse 7, 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh unto thee. And then finally, our third one, Psalm 121. Psalm 121, verses 5 and 6. The Lord is thy keeper. The Lord is thy shade upon thy right hand. The sun shall not smite thee by day, nor the moon by night. But now look at verse 7 also. The Lord shall preserve thee from all evil. He shall preserve thy soul. And that, of course, is what ultimately matters. All around you, in this tragic world, souls are being lost, are being hurt, are being taken by the evil one. But he cannot take the soul of the one who is protected by the God of righteousness. Now, that's our final point. Ultimately, it's what counts. Ultimately, we are protected. But ultimately, is it our own work that protects us? No, it is not, because our own righteousness is not perfect. But you see, there is a man who underwent an ordeal, and he was perfect. The man who was God sent to earth, Jesus Christ. Jesus underwent the ultimate ordeal, the ordeal of death. And of course, at one level, it looked horrible, didn't it? He not only suffered, he died, and he went to the grave. Did he not fail the ordeal? No, he did not, because death had no lasting power over him. You will not abandon your Holy One to the grave, say the Psalms. You will not let him see decay. Jesus Christ went all the way to and through death and still triumphed. Why? He was perfectly righteous. And the good news is, His righteousness has become our protection. What we can, in a sense, do here on this earth, to some extent, protect ourselves from disaster by righteous conduct, Jesus did for us ultimately and eternally. He is our ultimate protection. Isaiah 43. But now thus says the Lord who created you, O Jacob, and he who formed you, O Israel. Fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you. At the ultimate test, the day of judgment, 1,000 may fall at your right, 10,000 at your left hand. But you will stand in the righteousness of Christ. God has shut the mouth of our accuser. God has shut the jaws of sin. He has closed the jaws of hell, because we stand protected by the righteousness of Jesus Christ. And that is our confidence now and forever. Let's pray.